introduce yourselves in a moment so that we can all know who we are. So why don't we do it right now, so we're starting to introduce them.
Sure. Well, I'm Simone.
Maybe you can say a little bit about yourself, as in, what research do you do, and so on, so that I know roughly what your background is and what your aims might be.
I'm in the graduation group in Guelph, and I've been working on my first research project, which has to do with binary black hole system. I study black holes.
I'm from UWaterloo. I guess I researched like differential geometry, but the reason I like it is because I like GRs.
Yeah. Who's your supervisor?
Roxandra Morar.
Okay.
She's a geometer as well.
Right. I'm Taylor Bennington, also part of the publication group as well. I'm just in my first year here, so I haven't done much in the way of research, but I've learned from it.
I'm Stephanie Taylor, and I'm also part of the and I study calibration.
I'm Brandon. I work with Waterloo, and I work with Myers
stability
and
I'm Ron Fletcher. I go to Western, and I do research at Dallas Michelle, and we do research for the philosophies
in the conference.
I'm Chris Weiler, and I also go to Western. I'm working under Floyd Lansky.
Oh.
And actually, I'm not much
research. So I'm also from Western, also to Weiler, Floyd Lansky, and I do super
Oh, okay. What's your interest? And you are?
College of
Connecticut. Oh, all right. Okay. All right, so that's good. So there's a fairly diversified, set of expertise here. Who's registered in the course or intends to be registered? Okay. Oh, almost everybody. So you at Western, you can actually. So how does it work for you? Okay. Yeah. Sure. Okay. So. Is there anyone here who's not registered? Okay, so that's good. I think, I like the small numbers, and I like the fact that you're all registered. Last time I saw the course, which was, I think, 2 years ago, maybe even more than that, there was one registered student and about 25 people in the audience. And that was sort of a strange setup, but this is good. So. I hope, and I will be assuming that you've already had some background in general relativity. So, is there anyone here who hasn't really studied it at all or very little? So, you're all experts. So, that's good. So, this is really an advanced course in GR. So, I am assuming that you know basic elements of the theory, so that maybe you've had some introductory course before or you studied it by yourself. And what I'll want to do for this course is to raise the level to the next step. So let me just go through the course outline so we can get the modalities out of the way, and then I'll tell you about what I intend to do with the course, and then I'll start lecturing. So I give you my personal information if you want to get a hold of me. So typically, my intention is to be here every week, of course, to teach lectures. I'll spend the whole day. We have a session in the morning, session in the afternoon. In the middle, we have free lunch and colloquium, so it makes it a rather nice day. So if you want to talk to me in between lectures, there'll be time, right here. If you want to get a hold of me otherwise, you can get a hold of me by email or by phone, so all the information is there. About the schedule, so the second sentence is wrong. So I think originally we were supposed to meet in the theater in the afternoon, but we won't do that. We'll meet in the Alice room, which is the one directly underneath this one. So it's a bit of a smaller room, but for this number of people, it's going to be just perfect. And this room is also very good for that. The theater doesn't make sense unless you have a huge crowd. Turns out I found a really good book for this course. It's my own book. So it's no accident because, you know, the story was that, you know, back in the late 90s, I was asked to give this course, create this course, and I had to think about what I wanted to do. And, you know, I looked at all the existing textbooks and I decided that none of them were really what I wanted for the course. So I decided to write the lecture notes, and in time, you know, the lecture notes were improved and worked on and improved and augmented and all that stuff. And eventually it became this. One thing that happened, though, in the transition between lecture notes and book is that, well, the lecture notes used to be essentially free. The book was expensive, and one thing I could not do if I wanted to live with myself is to ask people to buy an expensive book. So you have two options, well, three options. You can buy the book right now, and I'll be happy if you do, and I'll pocket the money. Don't think otherwise. You have the option of waiting for a month or so when the paperback edition comes out. So Cambridge, it is up? Oh, you bought it. Oh, very good. Okay, so you can buy the paperback, so don't buy the hardback. How much did you pay for the paperback?
Okay. If you go to the bookstore, though, they charge you more, of course.
Yeah, so that's reasonable. That's good. But I give you the option, and that's the secret between you and I, of going to my website, so you have to find it. Find my website, find the section in my webpage that's called Lecture Notes, and if you go there, you'll find not the, you know, the latest version of the book, it's an earlier version, but you can find it there, ready to download for free. So all you have to do is print yourself. So all those options are open, and but one way or another, you'll need to have notes handy during and after the lectures. I'll be relying on them, obviously, throughout the course. Do you have a question? So I think probably there are copies available in the Waterloo bookstore and the Guelph bookstore, and I'm not sure if.
Okay.
So you can find it there, but probably the best option is to work it through Amazon or Chapters or, you know, probably Amazon.
It said it would come in 4 weeks, but I got it in 4 days.
Oh, okay. Yeah, because when I looked at the Cambridge University Press site, which is the publisher of the book, it said it would be ready in February. So I guess they overestimated the time. So anyway. So you have the option of doing that, or you can do it later. You can have a look at the downloadable version first and decide whether you want to buy it later. Anyway, all those options are open. Any other questions about this? So, you know, the book is really the core, so I'll be relying on those notes on the book very extensively. All during the lectures, I always try to find different ways of doing things, so you really should come prepared to take notes. I'd like to vary things a little bit. I've included in the course outline some additional references that, you know, I find generally useful. So they're setting up their books of varying level of sophistication. So some introductory ones like Schutz and Hartle. Carroll is sort of in the middle. D'Inverno is also in the middle. And then there's some more advanced ones like Weinberg and Wald. And so you might want to have a look at those books from time to time. There's some overlap between what I do and what is done in Wald, Well, the overlap is not that huge. Prerequisites, I said something about that already, so I am assuming that you have the basic elements of the theory already in your brain. So, for example, what I really assume in practice is that you know the material contained in the books by Schutz, for example, which is, you know, really introductory, the basic elements of the theory, some knowledge about cosmology, some knowledge about black holes, some knowledge of differential geometry, and I'll just take it from there. So I just part of what Carroll, you know, those are the sort of standard introductory books. Grading systems, so no exams in this course. I think, you know, this is the kind of course where exams would not be particularly useful nor pleasant. What I'll do is to give you homework problems. The homework assignment, the problems are all to be contained here. And so it's going to be homeworks and term projects. So really what I want you to do in this course is learn. And I want you to learn some new skills, new topics in general relativity. And, you know, a really good way of doing that is to solve problems. Another real good way of doing that is to study your own personalized topic. So the first task that you'll have to face is to find a topic for you to research throughout the semester. So it's a research long project. I'm looking for something fairly substantial, but the first thing you'll need to do is to find a suitable project for you to invest your time and study. You know, ideally, it should be something that's not directly your research project, because you know you want to take this opportunity to learn something new, something that interests you, but something that's not directly related to what you do every day. So your first job is to find a topic that has improved the topic. So what I want you to do before February 15th, 13th, is to send me an email containing maybe one or two paragraphs of your idea for a term project, maybe some references that you've looked up, you know, someplace to go and look to study the topic, and I'll tell you whether I think it's a good topic or not. And if you have my okay, then you can go ahead and start digging in. So I'm looking for something substantial. I'm looking for a term paper, you know, on the order of, you know, 20, 25, 30 pages along those lines. So really it's an opportunity for you to learn something new, something interesting, and then there'll be an opportunity for you to teach others. So there's going to be a term paper and also an oral presentation at the end of the course. I'm looking for something like a 20-minute presentation on what you've learned, and then we'll all benefit from your, you know, from your research. We'll all learn something about your topics. So that's what I'm looking for. So it's going to be 60% homework and 40% for the term project. The term project will sign a mark based on, well, the written report, the presentation. And that's basically it. I'm not sure what, you know, weights I'm going to assign to each, but, you know, there's going to be some weight to the presentation and some weight to the term project. Any questions about those aspects? All right. So let me tell you about the course content. So, you know, when I first decided to teach this course, I had to find the kind of course that I wanted to teach. And basically, there are two kind of options you can follow in an advanced course. One is to give, you know, something like a survey course. You teach a whole bunch of topics which are of current interest, and then you don't go into depth to any of them, but you try to survey a whole bunch of them, and that gives a sort of good introduction to all of those topics. So that's one option, and that's an option that I did follow through with. What I wanted to do instead is to really build a foundation for you to go and learn other things when you want to learn other things. So it's going to build a foundation before you go and tackle specific topics. And that's really what I wanted to do. And what I wanted to do specifically is to, you know, really try to address topics that seem to be well known from, you know, for anybody who works in gravitational physics, but are not necessarily well explained in textbooks, or not even explained in introductory textbooks, not covered in those books, sometimes covered in advanced textbooks, but sometimes not. So also useful techniques that that people use all the time, but seem to be learned by reading the literature as opposed to reading a textbook. So my purpose with writing this textbook and motivating the fact that it was not just a repeat of other textbooks was that I thought I was doing, you know, covering material in this book that was not covered in other books. And that's the intent of the course, to try to cover good foundational topics so that after that you're well prepared to go into the literature and read up on whatever topic interests you. Of course, you cannot cover everything, you cannot build a foundation that's going to be useful for everything. So I had to focus on certain key things. And the way of doing that for me was to try to think of what would be needed for a foundation to talk about black holes, and talk about black holes in a rather modern, advanced way, where we can talk about generic properties of black holes without having to necessarily write down the metrics. So, you know, it's a good start to talk about black holes to write down the Schwarzschild solution and look at its properties. It's another good start to look at the Kerr solution and look at its properties and all of that stuff. But there's an awful lot of results that can be obtained for black holes without having to write down the metrics. Results that can be obtained more directly without dealing to direct, you know, to particular solution to the Einstein field equations. And that's what, you know, that's, you know, the focus that I had when I prepared the course. And essentially what I'm going to be doing is introducing a bunch of techniques that can be then employed in the context of black holes. So let's just give you an overview of what I intend to do here. If you want to study black holes, the first thing that you need to, well, to define is where the black hole is, and, you know, the boundary of the black hole is the event horizon, and the main property of the event horizon is that it's a hypersurface of space-time. So it's a surface co-dimensional one, three-dimensional surface in four-dimensional space-time. But that surface has a very unique property. It's not a space-like surface. It's not a time-like surface. It's a light-like or null surface. So the horizon is the boundary between the block of interior and the block of exterior, and it's defined as null hypersurface or light-like hypersurface. So if you're going to study black holes, you have to study event horizons. If you're going to study event horizons, you have to know something about hypersurfaces. And step three is all about hypersurfaces, how to describe surfaces in the higher dimensional space-times, and in particular, how to describe light-like surfaces. To study space-like surfaces is fairly easy. To study time-like surfaces is also fairly easy. The null case is subtle, and a lot of what we're going to be doing in chapter three is to study the subtleties of light-like case, and that has direct importance to black holes. But once you study hypersurfaces, there are all sorts of other applications. For example, if you study space-like hypersurfaces, you have an opportunity to say something about the initial value problem of general relativity, and that's the thing which is very interesting. And if you're somebody who's looking to do numerical simulations of space-times, well, the first thing you need to worry about is to set up initial data that satisfy the constraint equations of general relativity. And I want to say something about that. That's an interesting application. And if you follow the literature on numerical relativity, well, this is something that you'll encounter, in each paper that does a numerical simulation of some space time, for example, collision of two black holes. So there's a lot going on when you study hypersurfaces, and I'll spend some time doing that. Another aspect of hypersurfaces is to discuss how metrics can be joined. So junction conditions. So suppose you have a part of space time that's described as one metric, and another part of space time is described as another metric. How do you join the two metrics at some boundary to ensure that the whole space time and the metric for that space time is a valid solution to the answer to field equations? You know about junction conditions in electromagnetism. The electric field has to have discontinuity in a certain way and continuous in a certain way. So all of that has direct analog general relativity, and it's very likely that I'll talk about that in the course. Now back to null, hypersurfaces. If you have null hypersurface, a light-like hypersurface, one property, very important property of that hypersurface is the fact that it's defined, or we say generated, by light-like geophysics. So words that I'll use a lot is the fact that you have light-like surfaces. If you look on the hypersurface, you find that there's going to be geophysics that are everywhere contained in the surface. And because they're contained on the surface, they must be light-like or null geodesics. So a very important property of light-like surfaces is the fact that they're generated by light-like geodesics. So those are also in the black context. The event horizon is defined by those light rays that, those proverbial light rays that cannot escape. So they don't go in, but they don't go out, they just hover there. So those null rays are following null geodesics, and those null geodesics are generating the hypersurface, the null hypersurface. So the technical term for this network of geodesics that's running on the hypersurface is confluence. And in order to study null hypersurfaces properly, you have to introduce, you have to introduce this concept of a congruence of null geodesics that generate the hypersurface. And that's, what chapter two is all about. Section two of the course is about congruences of geodesics. Congruence is just a fancy term for having a whole network of geodesics, one at every point in space-time, that sort of thing. So we'll talk about null geodesics in that congruence section. But again, there's subtleties associated with the light-like case. And in order to address the subtleties, we'll get there by looking first at a simple context where you have time-like geodesics instead. And there's also interesting applications associated with that. So that's the big overview. So I want to introduce, I want to build a foundation. The ultimate endpoint of doing this is going to be to study black holes in a rather advanced way. But I'll build all the techniques along the way, and I'll try to point to interesting applications also so that you don't have to wait until the end to do something physical and interesting. We'll actually consider interesting applications all the way through all of and all the while we'll be building that foundation that I was talking about. So that's basically it. The first thing that I'll do starting today is to just refresh our memory about differential geometry. I won't go very deep into that because I assume that you know the differential geometry that I'll need to use in this course, but I'll just say a few things just to refresh our collective memories. So, any questions? One thing I didn't say is that what I'm going to do, so I have a whole bunch of topics and the book is more than I can cover, so I'll have to make a selection and I'll do that sort of in real time depending on what I feel like doing this week. But one thing that I want you to get back to me on is, well, if you have topics you would like to, get back to me on. So if there's topics you would like to see particularly that are not included here, well, please let me know. And, I'll consider it. And maybe I'll say yes. But, it would be nice if you provide me with some ideas for topics that that might come from this course. I'm open for suggestions. Please think about it. Let me know either now or later or by email or what. Okay. One thing I should say off the bat is that, well, this is really a course in general relativity, and I'm aware that some of you are working on string theory. I don't think you're going to be wasting your time here because string theory is all about that. It talks about gravity also, on top of talking about gluon plasmas. So I think if you're going to do string theory in the context of doing gravity, quantum gravity, you probably need to know something about gravity in a sort of classical setting. String theory is a lot about constructing solutions to the equations of string theory, which in the low energy limit reduce to general relativity. One major distinction is that, well, string theory typically worries about spacetimes of a large number of dimensions, 10, 11, 26, depending on the context of the theory. So I'm going to do everything four dimensions in this course. A lot of the stuff that I'm going to be doing in four dimensions would generalize to higher dimensions. Some will not. You may ask me from time to time, does this generalize? I'll give you my best guess. I'm not an expert in higher dimensional spacetimes, but I am aware of some of the literature in higher dimensions. But just keep in mind that what I'm going to be doing here is classical, it's GR, it's four dimensional. The spacetimes I'll consider typically will be asymptotically flat, not asymptotically anti-de-Sitter. So it may not connect directly with what you know and what you do for research, but still, I think generalizations are often easy and very doable. And if you learn the techniques in my context, you'll be able to apply them in your own particular context. Without difficulty, I think. So we're good on that. Okay, so let's get started. So chapter one in the book and section one of the course is about what I call fundamentals, and essentially it's just a little refresher on differential geometry. And as I said, I'm not going to give you a course in differential geometry. Someone took a Heaps course last semester or previously. So you guys saw a lot of differential geometry. So maybe I could go around the room here and you can tell me sort of what you know and what you've done in terms of background for this course. Can you just give me a brief idea?
Yeah, so what kind of what have you done previously?
It's an intro to GR course. It's like a 400/600 of the new Waterloo. So we just did the Einstein field equations and then this, all the stuff to do with Einstein's work maybe. I'm not really sure how far he went, but then at the end we did a week or two on cosmology.
Okay, so yeah, that's exactly the background of this you have. So Taylor, I know about you, Steph, I know about you, who are under a seasoned workers, so everything. So how about you?
I had another undergraduate introduction in general ethics course, and
so which book or which
we did Schutz.
Okay.
And we did introduction of black systems, both Nico Weissmeyer.
Okay.
And I did my undergrad thesis was
a black. Okay, so good. So I think you're well prepared. How about you?
Yeah, I did a reading course on Andrew Lincoln's
book. Okay.
So yep. It was kind of a lot less formal than some other stuff. So then I also done a survey of Carroll's book.
Okay. Yeah.
I haven't done any of the cosmology.
Okay. what you know roughly about the universe and the Friedman Robinson Walker metric, and yeah, so that's been done. And how about that?
Cosmology calls with Alex, and there are about 2 chapters of TR.
Okay.
And I also read, maybe not the whole book, but read both of the book about more.
Okay, so you read the early chapters, they're all in control of the is done. Okay. Okay, so you know what a Riemann tensor is and what its meaning is. And, okay, so I think there's no problem with the back that's assuming. So I'll just say a few words just to mostly introduce my notation, my attitude toward differential geometry. Today I want to, once I'll go in some details to talk about 2D6, because that's, you know, that's really relevant for the whole of the course. I'll talk about the derivatives, and that's something that you may or may not have studied before, and I want to really go through that in some detail just because it's also a very important tool. And I'll just go through a whole list of topics. I won't go into a lot of details about that. All the details you can find in the textbook. I guess the more experience I've become teaching, the less inclined I am to do long derivations in class, because they don't seem to work all that well. I mean, if I do a long calculation in class, you'll spend all the time copying. You may not have time while you're copying to think about what's going on, and in the end, well, you get to the result. Maybe you have followed all the steps, and if you followed all the steps, then you did it, and that's good. If you didn't follow all the steps, then it was a waste of time, and you might as well do it by yourself. So bottom line is, you know, if there's a long derivation that's required, perhaps I'll just skip, tell you that you should do that for yourself, probably indicate some of the steps, maybe talk about the subtleties that it may contain, but my intention is to not go through very long derivations. I am, you know, encouraging you, though, to spend the time it takes to actually go through the details outside of the lectures. I think this effort that you have put in personally, spending the time it takes to go through the mathematical steps by yourself, you know, at your own pace, in your own time, is where you do all the learning. I mean, if you watch me do stuff in class, you'll convince yourself that I can do it. You might even get a false impression that it's all pretty easy, but if you force yourself to go through the steps in your own time, you'll figure out perhaps that some things that you didn't quite understand, or in any case, you'll learn along the way. So it's very important that you do spend time outside the class hours going through the details. Not that you have to go through everything necessarily, and you can pick and choose, but it's important that you make that effort outside the class hours. Okay, so let me talk about the fundamentals. And fundamentals for GR, I mean, the mathematical underpinning of GR is really differential geometry, so you already know a lot of differential geometry. I could give a whole course in differential geometry. Mathematical relativist has become very sophisticated in terms of differential geometry. If you read Wall, for example, if you read Carroll even, I mean, the amount of differential geometry that they produce is actually pretty sophisticated. It's very high. And now the typical relativist out there is somebody who's very sophisticated at differential geometry. If you read my book, you'll find that, well, it's not sophisticated at all, and that's a choice. I mean, I could have spent the first chapter developing the differential geometry from scratch, talking about charts, having those, you know, flow diagrams from the manifold to Rn and all of that stuff, and I decided, well, I didn't need to do that because you're supposed to know that. And for my immediate purposes in the book, I was very happy to talk vectors as something transforms as such on for transformation. One form is doing, you know, something that transforms differently, tensors as objects that transform in a specific way. Very old-fashioned, very pedestrian ways of thinking about differential geometry, but perfectly appropriate for my purposes here. So that's my attitude number one, is that, you know, you have to know the whole, you know, sort of set up differential geometry in terms of the advanced ways of thinking about this, because it's very pretty, it's very useful, and conceptually that's really the way to do it. But when you sit down and try to do a calculation, well, first thing you need to do is to set up a coordinate system. You will be evaluating tensor components in that coordinate system. So to think in terms of coordinates, to think in terms of an unspecified but existing coordinate system that describes your piece of space-time, is an essential piece of linear calculation. And one, you know, aspect that I kept in mind when I was writing the book is to make sure that everything that I do was pretty close to doing a computation. So you can work very high in the conceptual sphere and be very removed from what you need to do if you have to do a computation of something, calculate something real, or you can, you know, go down from there and work more pedestrian ground level and closer to a computational level, and that's what I really wanted to do. I'm not, you know, saying bad things about the high conceptual levels. I really like it, but I really need it for most of what I do here. So I'm going to stick to the ground, to the ground pedestrian level. So the first thing that you would need to do when you talk about control geometry is to introduce the notions of, you know, tensors, vectors, one-forms, tensors, and all of that stuff. And well, you know the story here, so I'll just introduce vectors. Instead of calling them one-forms, I'll call them dual vectors and tensors. And essentially all of that follows from a very simple drawing that I can make and a very, you know, very simple piece of mathematics. So I give you a manifold. So that's my manifold. I give you, so it's a piece of the manifold, so I'm assuming that I have a coordinate system in that piece of the manifold. X alpha denotes a coordinate system, and it's completely arbitrary. You don't care what it is, but, you know, I want it. I'm going to give you a curved manifold. And typically, I'll denote my curves gamma, and here I don't care whether the curve is time like space like or null. I haven't talked about the metric yet, so I don't care about the signature of the manifold nor the signature of the metric or the signature of the curve. But what I want to do is to, on top of this, introduce a function on the manifold and also introduce the notion of a derivative along the curve. So I'll compute the derivative of the function along the curve. So we have a function over the manifold. So if we have a coordinate system, of course, the function is going to be a function of coordinates. And what I want to calculate is the derivative of the function along the curve. And in order to do that, I have to give a description of the curve. And the curve in the manifold is going to be denoted gamma, and it's going to be described by, well, give position as function of parameter that runs along the curve. So I'm assuming here that I have a parameter that takes, you know, a bunch of values, running values along the curve. And what I need to tell you with our specified curve is what the position is corresponding to this value of the parameter, what the position is corresponding to that value of the parameter. So the curve is going to be described by saying that, well, the position of the curve is determined as a function of the parameter. And that's called parameter description. And that's what you need to do to describe the curve on the manifold. So those are specified functions, and this is just the assignment that, you know, the functional value for any given value of lambda corresponds to the position of the curve for that parameter. And now, once you construct the derivative of the function along the curve, which means the derivative of the function with respect to the parameter, and that, you know, comes from ordinary calculus because, you know, if I have a function over all space-time, I have a restriction of the function along the curve. The curve is parameterized by lambda, therefore there's no obstacle to constructing the derivative of the function with respect to lambda. And one way of evaluating this would be to say, well, first of all, I have to differentiate the function with respect to the coordinates. And then I have to differentiate the coordinates with respect to the parameter. And that's very simple, but already we've introduced all the essential aspects of differential geometry. So this little construction here, which is totally trivial, really contains all the essential information, and essentially all differential geometry is right here. Because what we've done is to introduce the concept of the tangent vector on the curve, which is that quantity right here. And we've introduced the concept of a dual vector. And what we have here is the contraction of the dual vector with the vector to give something which is an invariant, something that would not depend on the coordinate system. Each element here, the vector and the dual vector, is something that will change under a change of coordinates. But the package contraction that I get by contracting the vector with the dual vector is something that gives me a contraction. And, you know, differential geometry is summarized right there. That rest of it is just an implementation of this, where we also talk about tensors and so forth. So what do we have? Well, we have the notion of transit vector. Typically, I'll denote U. At least in the time-like case, I'll call it U and think that as the velocity of that trajectory. And U is going to be given by dx alpha b lambda, but if I use the functional form instead, it's going to be the derivative of functions z alpha with respect to the parameter. So this is an example of a vector. And can generalize this notion by saying that, well, if I figure out how this transforms for the corner transformations, which is, you know, easy to figure out, then objects that call vector are the objects that change in exactly the same way. We have gradient dual vector. And here there's several notations I can introduce. You know, the one that I use in the book a lot is the comma notation. Another one that might be used is the partial notation like this. Another one that might be used is the lambda or differential operator notation like this. But in any case, it's just the ordinary derivative of the function with respect to each one of the coordinates. And that's gradient dual vector. And it's a dual vector because the index here is down, the index here is up. The fact that here we're taking derivatives while here we're differentiating the coordinates means that the coordinate transformation properties of those two objects are different. This transforms like coordinates under the coordinate transformation. This transforms oppositely because we're taking derivatives. So we're defining two very different types of objects, and this is what I'm calling a vector. This is what I'm calling a dual vector. And the name dual suggests the fact that, well, what you do to form an invariant, well, it's like, you know, in quantum mechanics, you have ket and bra and combine them to get a number. Well, here we combine vector and dual vector to get an invariant, something that doesn't depend on coordinates, something that would be invariant under coordinate transformation. And so we have this, and we have scalar then, which is the contraction of dual vector with tangent vector. So in sort of modern differential geometry, the way it's all done is to say that, well, we first introduce vectors, then we introduce dual vectors, or sometimes they're called one forms, as linear functionals on vectors that give you numbers. That's what we've done here. We have linear operator. If I go back up here, we have linear operator in dual vector that operates on vector linearly, so it's a linear operation that gives you a number, so you can define dual vectors or one forms as linear functionals on vectors that give you invariant. That's the modern way of doing it. So that's the first step. And then, so you have vectors, you have dual vectors, and then you keep going, you define tensors as linear functionals of vectors and one forms that give numbers. And tensors can have, you know, a lot, you know, it can be a function of any number of vectors in one forms, and the number of indices that's assigned to the vector is going to be, you know, reflecting that. One more thing that's very important is the fact that fundamentally in differential geometry, vectors are always thought to be tangent to some curve. The real fundamental notion of a vector in differential geometry is comes from curves. So what comes first is the curve of the manifold. What comes next is a vector as the tangent to that curve. Now, there are some vectors in physics that don't, you know, really correspond to, you know, so the velocity vector is something that directly is formulated, defined as the tangent vector. The acceleration vector, well, is a derived quantity. But what you have to keep in mind is that in differential geometry, you should always think of vector as being tangent to some curve. Either you're given the curve first and you find the tangent, and that's the vector, or you're given the vector first as a vector field in space-time, and then construct the curve after the fact. So if you're given a vector field, you can always construct a tangent, a curve to which the vector is always tangent. So this association between curves and vectors is really very important, and it's always useful, or you know, sometimes useful, to think of vector fields as being tangent to a bunch of curves, to congruence of curves. There's one thing I want to describe this. Okay, so first comes the curve, then vectors are defined to be tangent, you know, tangent to the curve, dual vectors, like this one are linear functionals on vectors, and then tensors are linear functionals on vectors and dual vectors, and that's all the different geometry right there. Next, of course, you add details like, you know, parallel transport, things like that, which I'll turn next. Now, the last thing I wanted to say about vectors is that, in fact, once you think this correspondence between curves and vectors in differential geometry, there's a natural correspondence between vectors and differential operators. So the tangent vector is always the derivative of curve. So there's one-to-one correspondence between vectors and differential operators in differential geometry, and often people will use the notation that vector is differential operator. So they use the equality sign between the vector and corresponding differential operator. And you know, you can turn the equivalence relation to, you know, you can turn the equivalence between a vector and a differential operator into an equality and essentially define vectors like that. And that's often done. Before I move on, I just wanted to tell you something about notation. So I'm a bit old fashioned in my notation in that I use Latin indices. So since Wald, it's become fashionable to instead of using Greek indices. So my indices go from 0 to 1 to 2 to 3. So there are four possible values for the four dimensions of space-time. And, you know, in the days of FW at Weinberg, it used to be, you know, the standard to use Greek letters to denote space-time indices. And what Paul's done is to change the fashion to from Greek indices to Latin indices. And I think now when you read papers on GR, people will tend to use Latin indices as opposed to Greek indices to denote four-dimensional tensors. When I wrote the book, I had the opportunity to become modern as opposed to old-fashioned and to change my notation, but I didn't do it. And there was two reasons for that. Part is, well, I was raised on Greek letters, so I use them, you know, myself when I do calculations and when I write my own papers. That's not the reason. The second reason, which is perhaps a little bit better, is that in fact I use each notation. So I'll use Greek indices when I talk about 4D vectors. So vectors that are defined, or tensors that are defined, in a four-dimensional manifold. But because we're going to be talking about hypersurfaces, we're going to be talking about vectors that live on those hypersurfaces. Those vectors will be three-dimensional vectors. And I needed a notation to distinguish them. And I'm going to use the Greek, the Latin index, to denote three-dimensional vectors. So if I had wanted to switch my notation, I would have had to use this for 4D and this for 3D. And this would have been eternally confusing. And I probably would not have been able to keep it straight. I decided not to risk it for my own personal sanity. So I'm going to stick to the old-fashioned notation. Another old-fashioned notation, I think people don't use the comma all that much anymore. I think now people prefer to use this differential operator or that differential operator, and this will generalize to covariant derivatives. So I'll have to use the semicolon for covariant derivatives and the comma for partial derivatives. That's how it was raised. Again, Wald doesn't do that. Wald uses this covariant derivative operator everywhere. And I think that has also become fashionable. Anyway, this is just notation. You know, I'd like to get a push all about notation. You know, I do, but you know, I don't like it when I do. This issue here is, you know, it reminds me of a time where I was teaching in the morning. I was teaching this course. In the afternoon, I was teaching quantum field theory. For this course, I would use the metric convention minus plus plus plus. In the afternoon, I would use the metric convention plus minus minus minus, because that's what you do in quantum field theory. And that was so internally confusing, almost self-destructive that semester, it was very hard to keep straight. because science, you know, show up all over the place. Okay, so that's just, you know, my my very you know, quick introduction to vectors, dual vectors, and you know, you can generalize this to tensors. I won't do this explicitly. Let's just say a couple of things about covariant differentiation. So just keep the notation straight. So I notice here, there's somebody at McMaster, and I see you on my screen over here. Can you see and hear everything correctly? Okay, I don't think, I may not be able to hear you, but maybe you have a button. No, so I can't hear you, so we'll have to figure this out, you know, maybe for the afternoon. Anyway, welcome to the course. Sorry, I haven't talked to you yet, but maybe we'll talk later. Okay, so covariant differentiation. So it's very easy to differentiate scalars the way we've done here, but when we differentiate vectors and tensors, we have to be pretty careful. I just wanted to say a few things about this. I know you're aware of those issues. So again, this is my manifold. This is my curve. And suppose I have point T on the curve and another point Q on the curve. And suppose I have a vector field defined on the curve. So by vector field, I mean a vector that's defined at more than one point, and a vector field on the curve, that means that the vector is actually defined at this point on the curve, and I may not care about whether the vector is defined everywhere else or anywhere else. So I have a vector field on the curve, so let's say this is the value of the vector at t, or the picture for the vector at t, and this would be the picture for the vector at q. One very important thing about vectors in manifolds in differential geometry is the fact that a vector fundamentally is defined at one point. You can define it at many points, but a vector always refers to one point. So we do have vector at t, we have vector at q, and the best way to think about a vector is something that doesn't live on the manifold itself, it lives in a tangent plane to the manifold. So if you imagine, for example, the surface of a sphere, and you think of vector as being an object defined on a manifold, well, you would know what to do with the arrow. Does it bend on the surface of the sphere, or does it keep straight? Well, in fact, it does keep straight, but if it keeps straight, it has to stick out to the manifold, and what it does, in fact, is to, you know, is to, so it doesn't live on a manifold, it lives in a tangent plane attached to a point on the manifold. So that's what I'm trying to draw here. So the surface of the sphere is something like this. We have the sphere like this. Say I work at the North Pole. I can imagine sitting at a table at the North Pole. I think that's a picture from Walt's book. So he's got the apple. He's got the table on top of the apple. So if I don't want my arrow to be soft and, you know, sticking to the surface of the sphere, the arrow has to be tangent to a point on the North Pole, and that means that it's really defined on that tangent plane, which is something that comes on top of manifold itself. So, you know, there's five bundle description of all this. I don't really care about that. But just the basic point is that you can, so a vector is going to be defined at a given point. It lives in the tangent plane attached to that point. And if that's true, there's no way of comparing a vector here to a vector there because they refer to different vector spaces. Each tangent plane is its own vector space. And you can add vectors within, you know, attached to a given point. You can subtract vectors attached to a given point. But what you cannot do is to add vectors at two different points because they live two different vector spaces. And you cannot subtract two vectors that live at different points. And that means that if you want to define an operation of differentiation of vectors, you have to do something subtle because you cannot just subtract this vector from that vector and call that the derivative of the vector. That's not vectorial operation. And that's why we had to invent this notion of covariant differentiation, because what had to be done is to come up with a rule of taking this vector from its point Q, transporting it to point T, where it could be compared with the original vector at that point. And that rule is parallel transport. That rule comes with an extra structure on the manifold, which is the connection. And you can define a covariant differentiation. You can define derivatives of vector only if you introduce that additional structure. That rule tells you how to transport a vector from Q to P so that it can compare. So what you need, so vectors at P and Q cannot be added or subtracted. And that means that we need a rule to transport A at Q to a new vector, which I'm going to call the transported vector at P. And then we can define a derivative at P. So that rule is going to be a parallel transport. It's going to come with connection. And the rule will give us a notion of differentiation on the curve for vectors. So then we have the notion of covariant derivative, which has to come with its own specific notation. And I use the capital D to denote a derivative operator, which is the covariant derivative operator on the curve. So the covariant derivative operator on the curve is going to be essentially defined to be the difference between, let's see, I want to give the sign straight here. Yeah, it's the, let's see what, it's the transported vector at P minus the original vector at P. So we have a rule that allows us to take this vector to construct a new vector here, that transported vector will in general be different from the original vector, and the difference between the two is what we call the derivative of vector. So the definition is called the vectorial difference between the two vectors, and we divide by the increment in the parameter. And of course, the derivative operator refers to the rule by which we've transported our vector, and that's specified by the connection. So you have a derivative operator for each connection you put on your manifold, and in differential geometry, you have complete freedom in assigning a connection. In GR, we're going to choose a specific connection, which is going to be a Christoffel connection. So I'm just going to come to that in a second. Do you have a question?
Or do you call it the absolute derivative and then the covariant comes from?
Yes, I think you're right. So that may depend on which book you read, but that, you're right. This would normally be called the absolute derivative, and the covariant derivative would be the next line of notation I'm going to indicate in just a sec. But this is terminology. I don't think we should be too concerned about that. Okay, so what is it in more concrete terms? Well, I'm going to again introduce some notation. So the, as pointed out, the absolute derivative of the vector with respect to the curve parameter, I can express as the covariant derivative, and that's where I use the semicolon notation. The covariant derivative of the vector in the direction of the tangent vector, so that's what it means to take the derivative along the curve. This tells us that, this takes the derivative in any direction, but here we're tracking that to the direction of the tangent vector, which means that we're actually constructing the derivative in the direction of the curve. And another notation for this, as I said, which is the more popular notation, is where you indicate the differential operator explicitly like this. And you would group those terms together and leave the u beta alone. And all this notation, well, really means that you have, so the covariant derivative includes a partial derivative, but it includes an additional term that comes from the connection, which you recognize as being the usual Christoffel symbol term. that you write in this form. So the point here is that partial differentiation is not allowed because partial differentiation would be, so partial differentiation is not a tensorial operation because it would be a straightforward comparison between A at Q and A at P, and that cannot be defined as a tensorial operation. So this is something that cannot define by itself, a notion of the derivative of a vector. And it's something you can check would also not transform appropriately under Korda transformation. This would not have tensorial properties under coordinate transformations. The next guy is the connection term, and this is, this is how you specify how you're supposed to transport vector from Q to P in order to compare it to the original vector there. And fundamentally, in differential geometry, this is a set of quantities. There's a bunch of them that can be freely specified. So it's an additional structure. It's a structure you place on a manifold that instructs you how to do the parallel transport. It's the rule, it's the connection, it's something that is specified by an external agent, something that's not intrinsically defined. But the point is that while this and that are not simply tensorial terms, the combination is tensorial, which means that while this and that will not transform as tensors under coordinate transformations, when you combine them together, the non-tensorial terms in transformation will cancel out, and you'll find that this whole quantity right here, or this quantity right here, is a proper tensor. And you make it a proper tensor by introducing this additional structure, which is the connection. So this is the connection. And for our purposes right now, the connection is actually some set of quantities which are non-tensorial, which are specified by an external agent. And in differential geometry, it's not specified by anything. So I just wanted to really insist this notion that to define the derivative along the curve, you have to introduce this this additional structure on the manifold. That's very important. In a moment, let's see, it's 11:30, so we have an hour, about half an hour or more. In a moment, I'll talk about the derivatives, which are interesting because they allow you to, in fact, define a derivative of vector without making reference to an additional structure. So I want to talk about that because it's, from differential geometry, it's interesting. For our purposes in GR, it's also interesting. I won't go through in any details about this, but once you've defined the notion of covariant derivative of a vector, you can expand the definition to dual vectors, and you can extend them further to tensors by just demanding that the differential operator that you've introduced here, or here, or here, satisfies the Leibniz property. So basically, this is the way to define the covariant derivative of vector. The definition can be extended to dual vectors and tensors by imposing the Leibniz rule, which is just the product rule of ordinary calculus. So what I mean by that is, well, first of all, you define the covariant derivative acting on scalar to be just the same thing as the ordinary partial derivative acting on scalar. So there's no distinction when you're acting on scalar between the semicolon notation or the complement notation. So that's the definition. Then you demand that if you are acting with the covariant derivative operator on a scalar that is constructed from a vector and a dual vector, then you'll figure out what the action is on the dual vector by demanding that, first of all, this is a scalar, and demanding that this obeys the product rule. So essentially, you just write down the product property of the differential operator, and then you just figure out the rest. So we've already worked out what this is. We know what that is because it's just a derivative acting on a scalar. And from that, you can extract what action of the derivative operator on the Jupiter vector must be. And in fact, the answer turns out to be simple here. So in the context of the vector, you had partial differentiation plus the next term. Here, you're going to have something very similar, except that there's going to be a minus sign that comes from the fact that, well, you just throw that over to the left side, and that comes with a minus sign. So when you work it all out, what you find is that the covariant derivative acting on the dual vector is the partial derivative minus a connected term. And the hard part here is just figure out where the indices belong. And you get a lot of guidance by making sure that the indices match. So here I've said that, but I'm using the usual summation conventions. If you have repeated index, and if one is up, if one is down, you sum over them. That's the dummy index. And here we had to have a dummy index on P because P is something that's defined with an index lowered. So if this is a dummy index, this has to be a dummy index. It has to be in the upper position. And in principle, we would have to worry about the ordering of those two indices. But as we're going to see in just a moment, in GR, we have metric and we have a specified connection which comes directly from the metric. So we don't have, and that connection is symmetric under those two indices. So I need to worry about positioning those two indices. So anyway, so that's how you generalize the notion of covariant derivative from vectors to dual vectors, and then you just keep going. And you define them for each particular tensor you're interested in, so you can just build it up for tensors of arbitrary rank. And it's always the same story. You get the next term for each of the indices contained in the tensor, and it's either plus or minus sign, depending on where the index is located. So so just to finish the story about this before I turn to geodesics, so let me just say that, well, when you do differential geometry in the sort of mathematical context, you don't need to introduce metric. Your manifold could have, may not have metrics. There's certainly lots of manifolds that don't have metrics on them. If you want to do, if you want to use vectors and differentiate them, you will need to define a connection on your manifold, and you may have a connection without having a metric. And there's certainly lots of manifolds with connections but without metric. You can have, you can define positive elements in a manifold without having to define a metric. That's possible too. But in any case, we're not interested in differential geometry for the sake of differential geometry. We want to do GR with this, and the kinds of manifolds we're interested in are manifolds with the metric. The metric is going to be what represents a gravitational field. The metric gives us two things. The metric gives us a mapping between vectors and dual vectors. We can raise and lower indices with the metric tensor. And what the metric also gives us is preferred connection. There's a connection that's going to be compatible with the metric. That's the usual Christoffel connection, and that's the connection that is preferred in general relativity. So let's just introduce the metric then, because that's a very important aspect of what we're doing. The metric is some preferred second rank tensor, which is put on a manifold. So that's the structure we put on a manifold. It's supposed to define distance on a manifold. If manifold is, Riemannian, then all the distances are positive. We're dealing with, with a metric with all plus signs in it. And this is the quantity that changes a coordinate displacement into a real physical displacement. In space-time, it's a little bit more subtle because of the time direction, which comes with the minus sign. So we're dealing with Riemannian manifolds and metric, which has, a signature of minus plus plus plus. Anyway, you're aware of all that. But we're given a metric, which in our context is going to be a solution to the Einstein field equations. And what the metric gives us is a way, as I said, of mapping vectors to one forms, and also the metric gives us a connection. So if we have the metric, we're also given for free the inverse metric, which is G with the inverse all rays. And this is, you know, if this is represented as a matrix, this is just a matrix inverse. So the definition for this is that if you take the inverse metric and you multiply it as a matrix to the original metric, then you get back the identity matrix, which is represented by a Kronecker delta. So that's the formal definition of what the inverse is. I might as well say it now. We're going to introduce G as the metric determinant. So if you construct that matrix that represents the metric, you know, as a 4x4 matrix, then if you calculate this determinant, that's what it can be called G. And the square root of that, the minus sign, is going to be playing an important role to define volume elements. So the metric can be defined, so it can be used to map vectors into dual vectors and inversely. So if you're given a vector field or just a vector, you can actually define a dual vector by, if you're given a vector, you can actually get back a dual vector by just lowering the index with the metric. So this is defined a priori. You use the metric to define something which otherwise would be unrelated. And you have direct relationship between the vector and dual vector. So in fact, you know, I spent lecture distinguishing these things, but you know, in the long run, I won't care about the distinction because I know I always have a metric that gives me a relationship between them. So in the end, I'll probably call that vector or call that vector. I won't care about distinguishing them because the metric is there to give me the relationship. And the other way around goes too. If you're given a dual vector, you can get a vector from this by just using the inverse metric. And so that's the thing that the metric gives us. Another thing that the metric gives us is a preferred connection. So so the Christoff connection is the one which is said to be metric compatible. And what does that mean? Well, we just postulate, we just impose, and that comes from, you know, physical reasons like the principle of equivalence and all of those good things. But essentially what we say is that we're going to require the connection to be such that if I take the covariant derivative of the metric, we get zero. And if I write it fully, the covariant derivative of the metric, something that would involve partial derivative and would involve two Christoff terms, two connection terms with minus signs. And here I have dummy index mu. I take first index alpha, I take the derivative index gamma, and then I just mix and match. So I replace the alpha by the mu and I leave the beta alone. And then I repeat that for the second index, which is beta. And that's the full expression for the covariant derivative of the metric. And I demand that this is zero. That specifies the connection. If I also specify another property, which is the fact that the connection has to be symmetric. So I'm going to impose that of all the quantities that we can specify here, I'm going to pick those that are symmetric under the exchange of the lower indices. And I'm going to impose that the connection be metric compatible. Those are mathematical requirements that are required for physical reasons that are not required for mathematical reasons. But once I've made them, I've pinned down the connection completely. And in that context, it becomes the Christoff connection, or sometimes called the Levi-Civita connection, or sometimes called the Christoff symbols. And I'll come back to you in a sec. And that's the usual expression that you can essentially solve this equation for gamma given the metric derivatives, and you can compute the connection or the Christoff symbols directly from the metric. And essentially what that tells us is that once we have specified the metric on the manifold, we don't specify the connection independently. It comes as derived quantity. So in GR, connection is not fundamental. It's something that comes from metric. But in other areas, physics, in other, in other areas where the differential geometry is done differently, the connection would be independent of the metric. And there's some, in field theories, in engaged field theories, you have connections, but you don't have metrics. But here's a context where we do have metric. Metric is fundamental. The connection is derived from that. You have a question?
Yeah, I have some questions about those have to be anti-separate. Is it like gauge choice? It doesn't matter.
No, there's some physics associated with that.
That's right. So if they were not symmetric, there would be so the non-symmetric, the anti-symmetric part of it would be called the torsion tensor. If you had a torsion tensor, what I remember is what the physical effect of the torsion would be. But yeah, there would be some measurable consequences associated with the presence of torsion. I think spinning particles behave differently from what you do in this context. So there's physical reasons why you would like to set the torsion to zero and therefore stick to symmetric connections, but don't quite remember the argument clearly. Other questions? Okay, so what I've tried to do here is to just start, try to put general relativity in the context of, more abstract differential geometry. But for the rest of the course, I'm going to be happy to, to stick to the level of general relativity where the metric is fundamental, the connection is derived, and covariant derivative, the operation of covariant derivative will refer to this specific choice of connection and all of those subtleties that are pretty nice and interesting. I'll just happy to forget. I'll be happy to stick to this particular context here, but it's good to be aware that there are lots of generalizations possible, including introducing the tension, formulating theories that do involve tension, and a lot of people have invested a lot of time doing that. So I have about five. Let's say I have about 15 minutes left. I think I can complete the full hour and a half here. So let's start talking about geodesics a little bit, because those are very important. GR. So in my notes, section 3. So in a curved manifold, or in, any manifold where you have metric, the geodesic is a curve between two points that either minimizes or maximizes the distance. So it's an extremum statement. So if so let's go back to our manifold. We have our, we pick two points, A and B, in the manifold. We draw all possible curves on the manifold that might link those two points. And we do a variational principle to decide which one is going to be the one that maximizes or minimizes or more generally extremizes the distance. And the one that does is called geodesic. So it's a path of extremum length. And in this formulation, I define a geodesic in terms of length, which means that I need a metric. So this notion of geodesic is, refers to having metric on a manifold. There are other notions of geodesics that I'll mention a little bit later that that work without metric would work with a connection. So I'll just say that in a moment. But that's going to be my fundamental definition of what geodesic is, and it refers to a metric. And geodesics are important in general relativity because, it can be proved based on energy momentum conservation that if you're not, if you're freely moving in space-time, in a curved space-time, you will move along the geodesic. So those are paths of physical observers that are not subjected to external forces other than gravitation in a curved space-time. So clearly they're very important. So if we're going to describe this, we need a variational principle, but we know about how to formulate this. So yeah, I'll just take the specific case of time-like geodesics. So that corresponds to trajectories of observers in space-time. I can define them for space-like geodesics, but I'll start with time-like, and then I'll define null geodesics as limiting case of the time-like case where we let the speed of light, the speed of the observer reach the speed of light. And the variation principle is simply to say that, if I have a curve and if I have a parameter along the curve that I'll call lambda, then I can construct the infinitesimal of distance along the curve, I can integrate that, and I get the total length along the curve. And so I can, I'll just write it down immediately. The length in space-time between the points A and B is going to be expressed as an integral between A and B. We're going to be integrating over the parameter. And what we're integrating, of course, is the length of curve. And in space-time, I have to worry about the minus sign that comes from the minus sign in the time component of the metric. So what I'm actually inserting inside the square root is minus that quantity right here. And this is sort of obvious. If you forget about the d lambda over here, what you have there inside the square root is, apart from the minus sign, the squared space-time distance between infinitesimal points on the curve. So this is ds squared. The minus sign changes the sign. So this would be something that the time-like curve would be defined to be negative. The minus sign makes it positive, so I can take the square root. And what I've done is to divide twice by lambda. So what appears inside the square root is the tangent vector of the curve. And I've compensated here by multiplying by d lambda. And if you look carefully, you'll notice that, the integral is actually independent of the scale of lambda. I can rescale lambda without changing the integral. Or in fact, you can prove that you can redefine parameterization arbitrarily and not change the result for the integral. So that's an expression for the total length that's completely independent of parameterization. So that's the very essential property. So this is invariant under parameterizations, reparameterizations. Which means that I can go from lambda to go to any other parameterization, which is going to be a function of the original one. And I can change the integration variable from lambda to lambda prime without changing the result, because all the d lambdas will cancel out as they should. Okay, so that's the total length. And what we need to do is to externalize that, and we know all about this. We have something here inside the integral that we can call a Lagrangian. This is the parameter of the Lagrangian, and the Lagrangian will depend on coordinates through the metric, and it depends on the velocities through those vectors right here. And I'm using the dot as notation for dd lambda. And if you have a Lagrangian and you want to externalize the action, you plug that into the Euler Lagrange equations, and you work it out, and you're done. I'm not going to go through the details of that, but it's very instructive to do it if you haven't done it before. And what we're going to derive out of this is the second order differential equation for the positions on the curve. And that's going to be, Judy's equation. So what did you get? So, excitation. Means that all you have to do is plug the Lagrangian that we have, which is the square root, into the Euler Lagrange equations. You work it all out, and it takes, maybe a page of calculations or something like that. And what you get? You get the geodesic equation, which involves the second derivative of the coordinates. Involves Christoffel symbols and velocities, but the right-hand side is not zero. The right-hand side is proportional to the velocity. And kappa is something that, you know, you work out as a result of the calculation, is equal to 1 over the Lagrangian divided by, multiplied by the derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to lambda. So you've seen this before, maybe you haven't seen the geodesic equation in its generalized form with non-zero right-hand side. Am I right? So I want to tell you about this. I want to tell you the importance of kappa, because in the course, we're going to be working with the generalized form of the geodesic equation on a fairly regular basis. And I want to explain why it's useful to do that and how you can actually specialize this to the usual form where kappa is zero. So this is the geodesic equation. In general form. And in specific form, kappa would be equal to zero, and that would be the usual form. So what's the difference? So I'll try to explain that, and then we'll quit for lunch. Well, the reason why I get general states of the geodesic equation has to do with the fact that I insisted from the start that the parameterization of the curve is general. Perhaps I can find a parameterization that would allow me to simplify this. I haven't said anything about lambda. I have to make this special choice about lambda. And in fact, I made a big deal out of the fact that the action and the variation principle is completely independent of parameterization. So I never said that one thing we might do is to prop time to be the parameter, which is a standard choice. But what if I did? What if I did choose prop time as parameter? Well, if I do it too soon, I don't have variation principle. If I say from the start that lambda should be prop time, well, what is prop time? Prop time on the curve, I'll call it d tau squared, or no, the square of prop time is d tau squared. By definition, this is minus ds squared. So by definition, this is just the quantity that appears inside the square root. So if I were to make the identification d lambda equals d tau in the action principle, I would get a square root that's identically equal to 1. And my Lagrangian would not be about, would not vary along the curve. Along each curve, I would redefine prop time in such a way that the Lagrangian would be redefined to be 1 for that curve. And therefore, my variational principle would just collapse. It just wouldn't work. So I cannot choose parameterization to be prop time parameterization before I do the variation. But I can do it after. If I don't do it before and I leave the parameterization general, and in fact, I need to do that because one thing I need to ensure to, you know, when I actually work through the fine print of the variation principle, I need to be sure that the initial value for lambda and the final value for lambda is fixed. You know, in Lagrangian mechanics, you have to fix the initial time and the final time. Here, by analogy, we have to fix the initial lambda and the final lambda. If I were to change the parameterization along each curve, I wouldn't be able to guarantee that. So the variational principle really requires the property that the parameterization be, you know, be not specified, not rigidly related to the curve. When I go through the variation, I get this. But after the variation, after I've identified the extreme curve, there's nothing preventing me from specializing parameterization of the prop time. And if I do that after the fact, if I choose prop time after the fact, then the Lagrangian is equal to 1. And the derivative of the Lagrangian is 0. And kappa is 0. So prop time on the curve is d tau. So if lambda is set equal to tau after the variation. Then on the extremum curve on geodesic, L is precisely equal to 1, which means that dL d tau is 0, and that implies that kappa is equal to 0. If I make this choice, then I end up with Judy's equation in the conventional form. So that's the Judy's equation. And it differs from the general form by a specific choice of parameterization, which I might say is prop time parameterization, but in fact it's a little bit more general than that. So I'll call that affine parameterization. So what's an affine parameter? Well, an affine parameter is a parameter that is very intimately related to prop time, but still have freedom of rescaling the scale of prop time. We could multiply tau by a constant. We would modify the value of L to be another constant. It would be a constant different from 1, but we wouldn't upset that, and we would not change that. So any constant rescaling of prop time is a valid parameterization that doesn't change the form of that equation. And in fact, we have freedom in this. So an affine parameter, I'll call it lambda star to make sure that you distinguish it from any other parameter. An affine parameter is something that can be related to tau by a linear relationship. So I can change the initial value of tau, I can rescale it without changing the form of the affine version of the Judy's equation. So typically, in all the sort of elementary textbooks on GR, we only care about the defined parameterization. If the geodesic equation is introduced through a variational principle, probably people will not, the authors will not call a lot of attention to those subtleties that I just pointed out, but I think those subtleties are interesting, so I want to discuss them. We'll deal with the affine version of the geodesic equation from time to time in this course. There's some advantages in doing that. But sometimes there are advantages in dealing with the more general form. And when we return this afternoon, I'll point out a context where, in fact, it's interesting to, to stick with the general form. It's sometimes useful not to pick prop time as parameter. Sometimes it's, preferable to pick something else. It gives us a more convenient version of Judy's equation. I'll just conclude by saying something that I said before. If you look at that equation and you forget about where it came from, what the content of this equation is this. So essentially, I can rewrite this equation in terms of the tangent vector. So if I define u alpha to be the velocity vector, then what we have, in fact, is the statement that while the derivative of velocity vector plus the connection term is 0, but that's just the same statement as saying that the absolute derivative of velocity vector on the curve is 0. So when you look at that equation and you rewrite it in that form, which has something very obvious, you have the statement that the motion is geodesic if the tangent vector is parallel transport on geodesic. So another way of finding a geodesic differential geometry is to say that looking for a curve such that the tangent vector is parallel transport. And if you define it like this, you have freedom of defining a geodesic relative to any choice of connection you might have made. But now it's interesting because that definition, if you don't use the Christoffel connection, is different and distinct from the definition in terms of extremum of distance. So you have two separate notions of geodesics in differential geometry. One refers to minimizing the distance, which is the Christoffel, which will return the Christoffel connection. One which talks about parallel transport tangent vector, which may refer to a different connection, but will give you a distinct curve. So you can have manifold with curves that are GV6 and other curves that are also GV6. They just refer to different connections. It's not all that important, but it's a useful, you know, sort of fun thing to notice. If I stick to the generalized version of the GV6 equation, the statement is that the tangent vector is not parallel transport. The tangent vector, the absolute derivative of the tangent vector is proportional to the tangent vector. And that amounts to changing the scale, the length of the tangent vector as you move around. So I think going with that in the afternoon, we're going to see that if you stick to that form, the length of the tangent vector is going to be constant along the curve. But if you work the generalized form, in fact, length does change. The length will be readjusted, you know, along the curve if the parameterization is not it's not fine. So my picture for the difference between affine parameterization and general parameterization is something like this. You know, if you have your manifold and curve, there are lots of ways you can parameterize the curve. And if you try to pick parameterization, which is nice and uniform, whatever that might mean, that's a picture for affine parameterization. And the uniformity of parameterization is what I associate here with the constant C of the length of the tangent vector. But what you might have done instead is to you know, pick the same curve, but decide to cluster the parameterization here for some reason, and then it becomes wide over here. So you might have picked parameterization that is highly non-uniform along the curve. That would not be an affine parameterization. The tangent vector would be really, really short here, really long there, and that corresponds to this generalized setting here. So again, choice of parameterization is largely a matter of convenience. Sometimes it's convenient to use proper time. Sometimes it's not, and it's good to have the freedom to do something else if it's more convenient. So that's all for today, for us this morning. I'll see you in the afternoon. Any questions? Sign up sheet? Yep. Thanks.